Earlier this week, I asked my wife, Bridget, "Do you think I'm a germaphobe?" Without any hesitation at all, she said, "Yes." And I thought, really? You didn't even have to think about that at all. So I kind of gave her this look. And she was like, "Jason, when our kids are sick, you don't even hug them." And I said, "That is not true. I absolutely hug our children when they are sick. I just don't let them breathe on me." And she said, "But then as soon as you get done hugging, you go into the bathroom and wash your hands. You're totally a germaphobe." So this morning, just between us, I'm going to share with you guys a few of my germaphobic tendencies. Here are the things that just kind of gross me out. Schools. Hospitals. Fast food restaurants with play areas. Malls. Movie theaters. Pools. Especially baby pools. That's just gross. Rental cars, airplanes, buses, taxis, metros, basically all forms of public transportation. Restaurants, well, the list goes on and on and on. I won't share all that with you. But the one that stands out the most, public bathrooms. Yeah, I just cannot stand public bathrooms. In fact, I think all public bathrooms should be equipped with this. Have you ever wanted to be that guy, the guy that walks out of the bathroom and points to the other guy that you know he didn't wash up? You just know. That is so gross. I don't think there's anything wrong with my list at all. You might think it's a little quirky, but I don't think there's anything wrong with my list. My list is just fine, except if my list included people. Except if my list included some untouchable people that are around me that I try to avoid. Now, I'm not talking about running up and hugging everybody, but what I am talking about is if I search my heart, I know that there are people in my life that I would rather avoid. For some reason, I just don't want to be around them. Maybe their lives are just a little bit too messy. Maybe I know that every quick conversation turns into a long conversation. Maybe I know that they are carrying a lot of baggage and every time it just comes out on the table. But there are people that I turn the other way from. And if I were to bet, I'm probably not alone. There are probably people that you would choose to turn away from too. So let's do a little exercise. Just bear with me here. Don't shrug me off. Don't get disgusted because I've asked you to do something this morning. Just everybody's going to do it. Come on. We're going to have some fun. Everyone here, close your eyes. Really, close your eyes. Close your eyes. Now picture yourself. You're in a crowded place. Not here, not church. Let's get out of here for a minute. Picture yourself, you're in a crowded place. Maybe you're at the movie theater. Maybe you're at a sporting event. Maybe you're on a crowded airplane. The place is packed out. Every seat taken, except for one. The one right next to you. And lo and behold, when you crane your neck and look up the aisle, there he is. There she is. That one person that you wish would not be the person sitting next to you. There they are. There they come. It's as if life for a moment is in slow motion because you know exactly where they're going. Now open your eyes. Yep, even in the back, this isn't snooze time. Open your eyes. It's vivid, isn't it? We know exactly who those people are. It might have been a people group, so maybe you thought in general terms. It might be a specific person. Who's the very first person that came to your mind? You see, there's people that all of us would rather avoid. We all have untouchables in our lives. We all have the people that we would rather not have to sit next to, rather not have to spend time with, rather not be around. We all have those people. And you say, Jason, it's natural. We all have people that we would rather not be around. Correct, it's natural. But is it right? Is it right to have untouchables? So today we're going to spend some time looking at what Jesus has to say about untouchables, not only in terms of his words, but in his actions. How did he treat untouchables? Now, some of you are here today and you're not buying the whole Jesus thing. You're not quite sure about him. You're kind of on the fence. That's cool with me. I am so glad that you're here because what we're going to talk about today applies to everyone. It's not just those of us that might call ourselves Christians or we're regular church goers. It applies to absolutely everyone. So you're here to talk about a topic that touches everyone's lives. Now, if I look at the people that I've interacted with that have shared with me their thoughts, feelings, or maybe even I've just heard them speak on what they think about Jesus, at a minimum, I find that everyone believes that Jesus was a really good moral teacher. I find very few people that would argue anything other than that. So we all accept Jesus as being a moral teacher. So today, if you're kind of on the fence, that's cool. Let's just look to see what he has to say. Let's see what a good moral Jewish teacher has to say about untouchables. And that's where we're going to start. We're going to look in the book of Mark. So there's four accounts of Jesus's life. One was written by a guy named Mark or John Mark. John Mark was probably the scribe to Peter. Now, Peter was one of Jesus's 12 apostles, but even beyond being one of the 12 apostles, Peter was in the inner circle. And we're even going to see that in one of the stories we look at today. When Jesus went off and he took just a core group of guys, even smaller than his 12 with him, he took three men. That was Jesus's inner circle. And we're going to look at what Jesus did with this inner circle, including Peter, who is probably dictating this to John Mark. So we're going to look in the book of Mark, one of the gospels, and we're going to look in chapter 5, and we're going to start in verse 21. So you can turn there now, and I'm also going to pop the verses up on the screen for you. Verse 21, and when Jesus crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered about him, and he was beside the sea. So Jesus was in and around the area of the Sea of Galilee, and he was on one side. He crossed over to the other. Soon as he got out of the boat, crowds gathered around him. So the question we need to ask ourselves as we begin to unpack this story is, why would crowds gather around Jesus? What's the big deal? The guy came on a boat and jumped off. Why would people gather around him? Well, for a couple reasons. This is the peak of Jesus' popularity. So people are hearing about him, and they're hearing one of three things, probably. They're hearing he's a great healer. So he's actually touching people and healing them from illnesses and infirmities. So people are coming because they might have sicknesses and they want to come and be touched by Jesus and healed by them. That's going to attract some attention. Number two, they're hearing that he scares off demons. He actually casts demons out of people. Even if you don't have a demon, would you like to see the show? I mean, seriously, the guy's casting out demons. This is crazy. So you want to come and see what's going on here. That's reason number two. But reason number three is Jesus is teaching. Jesus is teaching. He's in a predominantly Jewish area. So most of the people that gather around him are Jewish because they want to hear good teaching. But Jesus attracts crowds. If you were a Jewish teacher at that time, so you had your local synagogue, you had your local place of worship, and you were a Jewish teacher, when you went out in public, people liked you. You had your little community. People followed you. People wanted to be around you. But you didn't gather crowds. Jesus gathered crowds. Hundreds, thousands of people came around him. So why would he gather crowds? The answer is he's probably teaching something different or in a different way than the other Jewish teachers. That's why he would gather crowds. So here's what we know about Jewish teachers, any Jewish teacher. A Jewish teacher was thought by the other Jews to have the bat phone to God. So at any time, a Jewish teacher could just pull up the bat phone and have a direct connection to the one true God. So that was pretty significant. A Jewish teacher also knew the scriptures really well. What were the scriptures at that time? Well, the scriptures were the Torah. That's the first five books of even the Bible we have today, starting with Genesis. That's the Torah. So they had those. Some Jewish teachers were adopting other letters from the prophets and historical books, but not all. But we can rest assured that all Jewish teachers were teaching out of the Torah. And we're going to talk about the book of Leviticus a little bit today, which is part of the Torah as well. Jewish teachers also had access to the temple. So there was one temple at this time. There was one temple, and that temple was in Jerusalem. It was the temple built by Solomon. And the temple was the place that Jews went periodically for special festivals. Now, the temple was unique. And number one, it was huge. It was massive. It was gorgeous and beautiful. And the temple had certain areas. And people were allowed to go into certain areas depending on who they were. Now, teachers were special. Teachers were special, so they could go into some areas. All the other Jews could only go into other areas that were just for regular common Jews. The temple had the Holy of Holies at the very middle. That was that where the presence of God was said to be. And then you had the Holy, which was outside the Holy of Holies. And then you had a bunch of courtyards, a courtyard for the Jews, a courtyard where even Gentiles, non-Jews could go. But we're specifically talking about Jews today. So if teachers were all special at that time, what was Jesus? He was extra, extra, extra special. If teachers gathered people, tens, hundreds, and Jesus gathered thousands, he was special. See, at that time, they believed that people of God, those that their lives were dedicated to God, we would look at a pastor or a priest today, but at that time, the Jewish teachers, their lives were dedicated to God. They were set apart. They were extra special. They were holy. And Jesus was attracting even more attention than the rest of the Jewish teachers. And by the way, this wasn't uncommon elsewhere too. I know I'm referring to just Jews, but even the Romans and the Greeks at that time in history, even the pagans, they knew that there was a separation between those that had the bat phone to God and those that didn't, the regular people. There was a separation there. These people were special. So now we continue. Verse 22. Then came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, and seeing him, he fell at his feet and implored him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live." And Jesus went with him. So what's happening in this story here? First off, we see that a ruler of the synagogue came out. A ruler at that time in the synagogue was either an administrator, someone that took care of the grounds, that kind of administered to the synagogue, or on the higher end, maybe he was part of the board of elders. Just like we at our Reston Bible Church have elders, they would have a board of elders, and those were the leaders of the church. So in some way, shape, or form, this guy, Jairus, is a leader within the synagogue. And he comes out, and seeing him, Jesus, Jairus fell at his feet. So what's up with that? Why would Jairus fall at Jesus' feet? Jairus is a ruler within the synagogue. There are teachers that he comes in contact with at his synagogue all the time. Why wouldn't he just go to one of his teachers? Why wouldn't just one of those synagogue teachers come lay hands on the girl? Why wouldn't they just heal the girl? Because Jairus knew that Jesus was special, that Jesus was doing things that other teachers could not do. So he falls at his feet and he begs him, basically. He says, "My little daughter," little, a term of endearment, "my precious little daughter." And if we look over, this story is recounted for us in three of the four Gospels. And if we look over in Luke, we find out that this just wasn't a daughter, one of many. This was Jairus' only daughter. He cared for her deeply. "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come, teacher, please, please lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live." And Jesus went with him. So now Jesus is on a mission. He's heading out. He's on his way to Jairus' house to see the little girl. But we read this. and a great crowd followed him and thronged about him. So a crowd came along. They had gathered as soon as he got off the boat. They were interested. And now there's the potential for a show. Something could happen here. Jesus could do something big. So they're not just going to stand there by the ocean and eat seafood. They're going to head out with Jesus and go and see what happens. So they start following him. So now imagine this mass of people all crowding around Jesus, following him as he goes down the dusty road towards Jairus' house. Verse 25, and there was a woman who had had a discharge of blood for 12 years and who had suffered much under many physicians and had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. So there's a woman there. Now, to capture the magnitude of what's about to take place, to grasp what's going on here, we need to unpack this a little bit. We can't just say it was a sick woman. We need to understand why this is significant. So number one, the woman, unnamed, is sick. We don't know what exactly is wrong with her. We know she's been bleeding for 12 years. So we don't know if that's a constant bleeding, if it's a periodic bleeding, if there's hemorrhaging going on. We don't know. All we know is that she's bleeding. So she's in bad shape. She's not, and this has been going on for a long time. But number two about this woman, if she is Jewish, which she probably was, because Jesus is in a predominantly Jewish area, and she's going to Jesus, a Jewish teacher, so she probably was Jewish. So assuming she's Jewish, she's unclean. She's unclean. Now that doesn't mean a lot to us today, but back in the time of Christ, cleanliness meant a lot in the Jewish culture. There was a concept of being clean and unclean. Another way of saying it is being pure or being impure or being defiled. If you were clean, that was just kind of the normal state. So there was nothing special about being clean. It just meant the normal state of being, it's the way things should have been for you as a person. If you were unclean, it meant that something was going on that was not normal. If someone was clean, they could enter into the temple in Jerusalem. They could enter into synagogue. They could worship. They could be around their friends. If they were unclean, they couldn't. Because if someone was unclean, that meant that they were impure. And if you look back in Leviticus and all the laws that were set up for the Jewish teachers, again, they were the gatekeepers to cleanliness, holiness. If they were unclean, they weren't allowed to enter into the temple. They weren't allowed to be around their friends because they would defile them. This is the law of defilement. Now, we know the law of defilement today. We might not use those words, but defilement means that something that is dirty or impure touches something that is clean and pure, and because it's dirty and impure, it actually changes that which is pure. It defiles it. We have an expression. We say a rotten apple ruins the bunch, which is true physically. If you take a rotten apple that's rotting, stick it in a bag with a bunch of good apples, we know because we've studied it that that rotten apple will emit gases and fumes that will actually start to deteriorate or rot the other apples in the bag. That's the law of defilement. When something is dirty or unclean or impure and it comes in contact with that which is pure, it defiles it. So we have this woman that is unclean because she's been bleeding. So let's look at a few examples of cleanliness. So if you're familiar with Jewish culture, you might know that a Jew, for example, wouldn't eat bacon. Now let's just pause for a moment. Bacon. Doesn't that sound good? They wouldn't eat bacon. They wouldn't eat anything made of a pig. They wouldn't eat shellfish. They wouldn't eat a crab or a lobster. That is because those were bottom feeders. They were dirty. They were considered unclean. On top of that, a crab or a lobster had legs crawling around in the ocean, which that's not what things in the ocean did. So it's crawling around on legs, which most things on land do, and it's eating dirt. It's cleaning up the bottom of the ocean. Same with a pig on land. It was unclean. We think of a leper. So Jesus went around and he interacted with lepers on a few occasions. Lepers were people that had a skin disease. Now we think of leprosy as in modern day leprosy. We're not certain based on the translation whether or not that's a one-to-one. When the scriptures say leper, that it was someone with leprosy. It just meant that there was a skin disorder of some sort. So why would that make someone unclean? Because that person was not in the way that they were designed to be. They were not in the state that they were designed to be because they had some sort of skin disease. That which was on the inside is now being exposed to the outside, leprosy or skin disorder. That's not how God made us. And because the Jews believed that there was a boundary between the exterior and the interior, when someone had a skin disease and their inside was exposed in some way, when there was blood, it was considered very, very dirty and unclean. So those are just a couple examples. So what does this mean for the woman in our story? The woman that had been bleeding for 12 years. This meant that she was unclean. Permanently. Permanently. What does that mean? She wasn't allowed in the temple. She wasn't allowed in the synagogue. She wouldn't spend time with friends. She was isolated. No one would come near her. She was untouchable. Untouchable. Because if someone made contact with the woman that was bleeding, because of the law of defilement, that would carry over onto them, and then they would be unclean. And if they wanted to be around their Jewish friends again and go into the synagogue and worship on the Sabbath, they would have to go through the process of ritual cleaning, which there are several laid out, but the most predominant was a bath. So they would have to take a bath and wash away that uncleanliness before entering into the synagogue or the temple. No one wanted to be unclean, and no one wanted to spend time with a woman that was unclean. I'm a sports guy, so like it or not, in some sick and twisted way, everything goes back to sports in some way. So I think of it this way. When you're playing a basketball game and somebody runs into you, scratches your arm, breaks skin, and you start to bleed, you have to leave the game because nobody wants to be exposed to your blood. So the referee will blow the whistle, say a timeout for that player to leave the court. You would have to go over, get washed off, bandaged up before you enter back in to the game. You would have to leave the game and become clean before you entered back in because you were unclean when you got cut. That's kind of like the temple, sort of, kind of like the temple. So if somebody was unclean, they weren't allowed back into the temple until they were made clean again. I think you guys are getting it. All right, so let's carry on. 26, not only was she suffering for 12 years, but we see that she had suffered under many physicians and had spent all she had. This would be expected if we understood historically what was going on at the time. The Greco-Roman world had significant advancements in terms of medicine, in terms of surgeries. So they were light years ahead of the former years in terms of medical abilities, but they were very, very expensive. So now you have this woman that if she wanted to be treated for her bleeding, she would have to go to one of the doctors, one of the physicians, and it cost her everything she had. So she's broke. But on top of that, she's shunned. Because if you were a Jew and you believed in the one true God, Yahweh, and you believed that he was the great healer, that he could heal you, if you went to a physician, you had lack of faith. So she went to physicians, spent all she had, didn't have anything left. And on top of that, now she was not only unclean, but she was shunned because she didn't have faith. She was in bad, bad shape. Verse 27, she had heard the reports about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. She heard about Jesus, and she wants to go out because she knows that this is a really, really special teacher, and he's proven that he has healing capabilities. So she wants to go see him. But the problem is, he's surrounded by Jews, all the Jews that know her. So I don't know exactly, the scriptures don't tell us what happened here, but I'm thinking that she probably put on something to cover her head. kind of went incognito. She goes out into the crowd. She sees where Jesus is up ahead. She starts pushing her way through the crowd. Mind you, as she's pushing, she's defiling every Jew that she comes in contact with. Defile, defile, defile. Works her way up to Jesus and then touches his garment. Wow, she had some courage, didn't she? She was shunned. She was an untouchable. Why would she do that? Well, it tells us why she would do that in verse 28. For she said, if I touch even his garments, I will be made well. Based on Jesus' reputation, she knew that if she touched his garments, at least she thought that she would be made well. So she decided to do it. Now, remember what we said about defiling and making unclean the Jews around her? Well, one group of Jews wouldn't come anywhere close to uncleanliness: the teachers. So not only did she defile each person she came in contact with as she approached Jesus, but now she touched Jesus, which defiles him, the teacher. At least that's what tradition would tell us. Let's continue to read on. Verse 29, and immediately the flow of blood dried up and she felt in her body that she was healed from her disease. Could you imagine that? I can't even fathom having a cold for a month, let alone having something go on with my body for 12 years. And I know some of you have had that feeling. And she touched him and it was gone. It was just gone, just like that. And she knew instantly that she was healed. Verse 30. And Jesus, perceiving in himself that he had been defiled. That's what we would expect to happen, right? Because when someone that's unclean touches someone that is clean, that person becomes unclean. That person becomes defiled. So Jesus knew that he had been defiled, right? Is that what your version says? No, and that's not what it says on the screen either. That's not at all what happened. That's what we expect would happen, because that's what would have happened to any Jewish teacher, any Jew. That's what would have happened, but that's not what happened. And Jesus, perceiving in himself that power had gone out from him. Jesus knew that power had gone out from him. Jesus is the only person in history to break the law of defilement. Instead of the unclean making the clean unclean, the unclean touched the clean, the holy, the person of Christ. And instead of defilement, undefilement. That's the power that Jesus has. That's what Jesus did in the midst of all of these people. That's what Jesus still does today. Immediately turned about in the crowd, he said, "Who touched my garments?" He wanted to know who touched them. Natural reaction from the disciples here in verse 31. And his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing around you, and yet you say, 'Who touched me?' What are you thinking, Jesus? It's a crowd. You're in the middle. Everyone's pressing up on you. Of course you got touched. You're getting touched every which way. There's people all around you. What do you mean?" But Jesus knew. He looked around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. If you're the woman, how do you feel right there when Jesus turns around and is looking for you? She's scared. Here she is. She mustered the courage to come and track down Jesus in the first place. She touches him. She just wants to sneak out the back door. She's like, score. And Jesus calls her out. She's scared to death. This is her worst nightmare. that Jesus is now looking for her. Why is she scared? Well, she knows Jewish custom. She just touched someone that was holy. So what if he's angry? What if he's mad at me? I don't know how he knows I touched him. All I did was touch a tassel. I don't know how he knows, but what if he's angry? What if he condemns me in front of the people? What if he tells the people that who I really am? They know that I'm unclean, but what if he just rails me right here? Even worse, what if he takes it back? What if he takes it back? 12 years I've been waiting. She was scared, but she came up to him. She told Jesus the whole truth. And Jesus said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." The total opposite of everything that she feared. Jesus says, "Daughter." A term of endearment. "Daughter, my love child." We don't know how old this woman was. It's likely that she was older than Jesus, but he refers to her as if he is her father. "Daughter, your faith has made you well." Your faith, even though it was kind of suspect, a little messy, you know, the whole robe over your head thing, sneaking up through the crowd, even though it wasn't a good looking faith, even though you didn't do things the way that most people thought you would do things, your faith has made you well. And then he concludes by saying the obvious, that he had healed her. "Go in peace, be healed." She knew she was healed, but he says, "Be healed of your disease." Now, the other important historical aspect that we have to consider here is that a lot of Jews, not all Jews, but a lot of Jews still at this time, at the time of Christ, saw a direct connection between your behavior and your physical disposition. In other words, if someone was walking around and they had a disease, or if they were suffering in some way, if they were a leper, if they had a crippled hand, it was probably because they deserved it because of their sin. And if it wasn't because of their sin, it was because of the sin of their father or their mother or someone else in their family lineage. There was a connection between sin, the things that you do wrong, and how you are health-wise physically. So there was also a connection between healing and forgiveness, because if you had some sort of physical ailment because of your sin, if you were cured, it was because you were forgiven. So here, the woman is told that she's not only healed, but she's forgiven. And for the Jews around, they heard that and they knew that. Folks, when you hear people tell you that Jesus was a really nice Jewish teacher, no Jewish teacher would do this. No Jewish teacher would allow themselves to be touched like this. No Jewish teacher would heal and forgive in the way Jesus did. But let's continue on, because we still have this guy by the name of Jairus. "So while he was still speaking, there came from the ruler's house," Jairus' house, "someone who said, 'Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?'" So this guy on the tax scale of 0 to 10 gets a -3. All right. Could you imagine telling someone? Some of you are thinking, boy, I'm really bad at funerals, like uncomfortable. What do I say to folks? But this guy makes me look like a rock star, because he's terrible. He walks up in the crowd and says, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" In other words, why bother the teacher? Number one, she's dead. And teachers teach. Teachers don't raise people from the dead. Teachers teach. Teachers don't come and spend time with dead people. Why? Number two, because teachers do not go in the presence of the dead. So when we talked about those things that were clean and unclean, a graveyard, that which is dead, completely unclean. A Jewish teacher would never enter into a graveyard. A Jew avoided contact with someone that was dead. Now, it would happen. So if a family member of yours passed away and you had to carry them out to be buried, that was common. It was natural. It would have to happen. But soon as you were done doing it, you would then go and get clean, because it was unclean to touch a dead body. So why would a teacher come? Jairus, leave him alone. Your daughter is dead. Verse 36. But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the ruler of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." And he allowed no one to follow him except Peter and James and John, the brother of James. There's that inner circle of Christ, that inner circle of people, Peter, James, and John. Verse 38, they came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue, and Jesus saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. Now, this is hard to grasp today, but back then, there were actually professional mourners. So these were people that were used by the synagogue, and when someone passed away, as if it weren't bad enough that the family was there all upset and grieving and mourning, they would bring in the professionals. I really have no idea what that's like. Louder, I don't know. But they came in and they were weeping and mourning there at the house. They probably got there pretty quickly because Jairus is one of the he's one of the leaders in the synagogue. So they got there quickly and started doing this. So Jesus walks up and he sees this. And when he entered, he said to them, "Why are you making a commotion and weeping? This child is not dead, but sleeping." So now Jesus, in kind of a roundabout way, insults them, or at least they perceive it as being an insult, because he says, you don't even know if someone's dead. She's not dead, she's just sleeping. And they think Jesus is absolutely crazy for saying this, that she's not dead. And how do they respond? Verse 40, they laughed at him. So they're professional mourners, so they can kind of like turn it off, turn it on anytime they want. So they're like, boo hoo hoo hoo, ha ha ha, boo hoo hoo. So they switch back and forth. Continuing in verse 40, but he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was. So here we are, a bunch of Jews going into where a dead body is, push everyone outside, enter into her presence. Verse 41, taking her by the hand. Will Jesus just stop doing this? Didn't he read the rules and regulations of being a Jewish teacher? You don't touch dead people. Come on, Jesus. He sure isn't a very good Jewish teacher, is he? He's breaking all the rules. Here we go again. One thing that he absolutely should not have done is gone in and touched the hand of this child that had died. But that's exactly what Jesus did. Why does Jesus do that? Because he's not a Jewish teacher in the sense that we think of it. Yes, he did come to teach, but he wasn't restricted like a Jewish teacher because he was the Son of God. Only the Son of God could go in and undefile the defiled. Only the Son of God could go in to a situation where everyone else would have been made unclean. And he is not made unclean. Taking her by the hand, he said to her, "Talitha kumi," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, arise." And immediately the girl got up and began walking, for she was 12 years of age, and they were immediately overcome with amazement. Only the Son of God could do what Jesus did. As I reflect upon these two accounts and Jesus' interaction with the untouchable, I came up with this list. Only Jesus, the Son of God, wouldn't mind being touched by someone that was impure, by an untouchable. Only Jesus could be touched by the unclean and not become unclean. Only Jesus didn't mind being interrupted in the middle of a miracle. He's on a mission to go to Jairus' house. All of a sudden, he's got to take care of this unclean woman. No worries. He's got it covered, takes care of that, continues on. Only Jesus could heal a woman with bleeding in the way that Christ did. Only Jesus would come near an untouchable dead body. All other Jews, if they weren't family, would avoid it. Jewish leaders certainly would have avoided coming in contact with a dead body. But Jesus goes into the room and takes her by the hand. Only Jesus could break the law of defilement. Only Jesus could undefile that which was defiled. Only Jesus could raise a little girl from the dead, proving that he had power over death. Only Jesus could take something as revolting in that culture as a cross. It's recorded for us that they believed that a man was cursed. There was no worse form of death than a cross. But yet Jesus makes the cross beautiful. Now, some of you caught this as we were reading through, maybe for the first time. But you read 12 years. She suffered for 12 years, being the woman with the bleeding, and the little girl was 12 years old. It's not a coincidence that God puts that into the word for us. So what does it mean? What's the significance of 12? Well, we're not told. We don't know exactly. But as I reflected upon it, I thought, isn't it amazing that on the one hand, you had a woman that was dying for 12 years, and she knew it. She was suffering. She was bleeding. She felt pain. She felt isolation. She was alone. She was dying for 12 years. And on the other hand, you have a little girl that was living for 12 years. And if for those of you that have a little girl or have seen a little girl grow up or even witnessed it, you know that up through 12, a little girl lives. She really lives. Jesus comes to the person that is dying, the untouchable, for 12 years and brings life. Jesus comes to the girl that was living for 12 years and kind of going around on her own and reminds her that death can come at a moment and it's over. Chances are you're in one of those camps or have been at some point in your life. Some of you in here were or are untouchable. You feel isolated. You feel alone. You feel judged. You feel unclean. You feel not worthy. It's a slow death. And Christ reaches out his hand to the untouchable, and he says, I have life for you in me. Some of you are on the other side where everything is going well, seemingly. Everything is going well. You got the job, maybe you got the wife, got the kids, got the car, got the house. Everything's going along. And we're reminded that death is right around the corner. And without Jesus, death is permanent. Death is eternal life, eternal eternity in hell without Jesus. But Jesus comes to give life. For this little girl, she had died, and Jesus brought her back, gave her life. For us, Jesus knows that someday we will die because the mortality rate is 100%. But the question is, what happens when we do? Jesus came to touch, to remind through this little girl that there is life beyond this life. Whatever that is, 12 years, 50 years, 80 years, there's more. There's eternity with Christ. But we are unclean. All of us at some point were untouchable. All of us were untouchable in the sense that, remember how we looked at that temple? We talked about the temple earlier. None of us were welcome into the presence of God. None of us would enter into the Holy of Holies. Even if you were Jewish, if you have Jewish roots, you wouldn't go into the Holy of Holies. But you know what happened when Christ died on the cross? There's this neat little verse that's put in there at the end of the Gospels. When Jesus shut his eyes and he died, it says that the curtain that separated the Holy of Holies from the other areas of the temples, that it was torn down the middle, inviting anyone that wants to be in the presence of God into his presence, both now and for eternity. That's what Christ did. Even though we were unclean, we were untouchable, unworthy of his love because of our actions, Jesus paid the penalty for that, and he says, the temple is now yours. Come into my presence now and forever. Now, you might expect that when we talk about untouchables and we have a message like this, when you walk out those doors, that there's going to be this sign-up extravaganza. Sign up for Guilford Elementary. Sign up for the food bank. Sign up for this. Sign up for that. But that's not the response that we desire. See, we can respond emotionally, and we can respond devotionally. An emotional response says, I feel really bad. Jesus died on the cross for me. I accepted him. I am a Christian, but I need to give back. I need to do something for him. I need to make it up. I need to do this and do that and jump on and start doing all of these things. That's the emotional response. I want to touch the untouchable. But Jesus calls us to a devotional response. A devotional response says, I was untouchable, unworthy of the touch of Christ. And he touched me. He reached out. And now I'm filled with his love and his compassion and his mercy because of what he did for me. And I'm just filled more and more and more. And eventually that overflows me. And it flows out into the world around me. That's a devotional response. Not what do I need to do, but what is Christ going to do in me because of what he's done? Because it's not about what I'm doing. It's about what he's doing in me. And when the Holy Spirit is in me, when Christ is working through me, it changes me. It makes me want to touch the untouchable. You can have more impact than a church program. If I think about my own life, in the past month, I've had two individuals that I didn't even see a need. I didn't see anything. I just had two individuals in my life that Jesus said, you need to go and touch them. You need to be me to them. Those individuals will probably never step foot inside of this building. Jesus didn't call them into the temple. He went out to them. Jesus touched the untouchable by going out. He went out to them. We get excited sometimes. We give each other chest bumps because we invite somebody to church. Jesus wants you to go out into the community and touch people. My ask of you this week is this. Just look around. Don't do anything. Don't do anything out of emotion. Just look around and see if there are some untouchables in your lives. Consider whether or not there's a reason why the widow lives next door. Consider why the child on your kid's basketball team doesn't have a father. Consider why the kid at school that sits right next to you in math class, nobody talks to him. He's untouchable. People flee. They avoid him at all cost. Why are you sitting next to him? Consider the person at work that's having all the marital problems. You know, the guy that shows up at the coffee machine, and every time you ask him how he's doing, it's like everything comes out. His whole life, and people will avoid him. Consider the untouchables. What untouchables has God orchestrated to be in your life right now? You have way more potential than a church program to go out and touch the untouchables. And when we're filled with the love of Christ, it's natural to go out and seek and be the hands and feet of Christ. And people will view it and say, that is amazing. Amazing. Let's pray. Father God, thank you for reminding us this morning that we, at some point, were all untouchable, unworthy of being in your presence because of our sin, because of our turning away from you. But Lord, you came down to touch our lives, to not just make us clean, Lord, but to make us holy, to welcome us into your presence. Father, thank you for the tremendous gift of the cross. Lord, let us now go out and just look to see if there's some untouchables around us that you have put there for a reason, Lord. Father, could we touch them for your glory and honor? Father, give us the courage and the wisdom to do so. We pray these things in Christ's name.